Oh, thanks, Kai. I know that I'm speaking here mainly to a community to which I am not so familiar, even though I'm interested in disordered systems, and I did not really apply the functional renormalization group myself to these disordered systems. Other people have done. I'm coming here to learn to a certain extent, not only to a certain extent, I'm coming here to learn how possibly one can make use of functional renormalization and of this particular functional renormalization group that I will present you for disordered systems. And I thought a good point for starting the contact is perhaps that I just explain you my way of viewing functional renormalization. The basic problem is, of course, a very simple one. The basic problem is coming from some laws that are formulated at short distances, microscopic theories. So you may think about some lattice theory, or for particle physics, some theory at the Planck scale. So we have some microscopic theory, and we have to compute what happens at macroscopic distances, distances much smaller than these microscopic scales. And very often at these macroscopic scales, we have to use some effective theories where observations are made. And the bridge from the microscopic theory to the effective theory is, of course, very often a complicated one. Often the effective theory even involves completely different degrees of freedom, and this is of course a very old idea. Perhaps one of the oldest example of an effective theory concerns the motion of planets around the sun. Definitely we do not have to understand the microscopic degrees of freedom like the burning of hydrogen in the sun in order to study Kepler's laws. So the basic idea is an old one. Question: how to implement it in practice? It's not a simple one, and it's in general not as simple as for planets and the sun. I will give you a simple example from particle physics. Short distance and long distances, the degrees of freedom in strong interactions are really different. Short distances are well described by quarks and gluons. Long distances, everybody knows, it's hadrons, it's baryons and mesons. And for example, one of the challenges that a method that links short distances to long distances, one of the challenges it should make is how to explain how to make the transition in this case of QCD that I will not discuss today, mainly because it's more condensed matter and statistical physics context here. In this context, we know that, for example, we have to understand confinement and the chiral phase transition. But what is common to all that, both particle physics, for example, QCD, and statistical physics, is that whenever we have effective strong interactions, collective degrees of freedom play a major role. And I will briefly demonstrate that with the Hubbard model, since we will turn to that a little later in this lecture. So you all know the Hubbard model describes electrons, let's say on a cubic lattice, or for example we will concentrate on two dimensions, so on planes. It has a repulsive interaction when two electrons are on the same side, and it has hopping between two neighboring sides, and the action is that readable? Yeah, okay, that's fine. Now. And the action takes a simple form. I have written here immediately in the form of a partition function. So we have a functional integral over fermionic degrees of freedom, Grassmann degrees of freedom, and then the action contains the usual time derivative. This is a non-relativistic theory, so it's linear in time, and this is of course Euclidean time on the torus and the chemical potential. So this is for all non-relativistic fields. Then it has this next neighbor hopping here, and it has a point-like interaction when two electrons sitting on the same side. So external parameters are temperature and chemical potential, and the Hamiltonian is characterized by an additional parameter which just tells you the coupling strength. So this is a standard simple model, and in solid states it's more or less a model for everything. So antiferromagnetism, height, CC, superconductivity, metal insulator transition, ferromagnetism, all are described by different ranges in parameter space. Now let me come to a first result in order to motivate that these methods I will present you can really do things that are not easily done with otherwise. The first result is describing antiferromagnetism in the two-dimensional Hubbard model. So you have a given coupling strength here. It's actually at chemical potential zero. And this is really a curve that describes the antiferromagnetic order parameter as a function of temperature in the low temperature phase. So this is the ordered phase, so it's spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this is, of course, in this case, non-vanishing antiferromagnetic order parameter. There is some critical temperature. Well, why is this curve non-trivial? This curve is non-trivial because actually, if you think about it, there should be, by exact theorems, no order in the low temperature phase. It's a two-dimensional model. The symmetry is a continuous non-abelian symmetry, SO3, and that cannot be spontaneously broken. I mean, this is the Merman-Wagner theorem that tells you that the order parameter has to vanish. So how do we get, nevertheless, this curve? I mean, you can, of course, get it in mean field theory, but this is just really not leading you anywhere, because it will never be consistent with the Merman-Wagner theorem. What really appears here is that this antiferromagnetic order is a finite size effect. So the curve I was showing to you corresponds to a scale of an experimental probe of 1 centimeter. And indeed, if you would really go to infinite volume, the order parameter would vanish. But it vanishes extremely slowly. It vanishes only logarithmically. So the dependence on the probe size is actually very weak. And you can really reliably compute an order parameter as a function of temperature for some realistic range of experimental probes. And the little shifts of this curve when you change your experimental probe is minor. Simply, the basic physics behind it is that the Goldstone boson fluctuations, which would destroy the order only if you take Goldstone boson fluctuations with arbitrarily small momentum into account, and in a finite size system, you have, of course, an infrared cutoff due to the experimental size, and therefore the order will not completely vanish and you get a realistic curve. I choose this example because it has already introduced the notion of an effective infrared cutoff. So in this case, we have an effective infrared cutoff given by physics. We will later use an infrared cutoff that we just put in by hand and vary this infrared cutoff and study what happens. Another point why I have taken this example for a motivation is that definitely collective degrees of freedom are crucial. So for t smaller than tc, the order parameter is a fermion bilinear, so psi bar, psi dagger, sigma psi. This is, if you want, a type of magnetic field. This is, of course, a bosonic field. And the particular antiferromagnetic order is when the bosonic field switches sign when you go from one lattice side to the next one. And as an effect of the non-vanishing order parameter, you will, of course, produce, in this case, a gap for the fermions. So it is obvious that the real long-distance physics is not given anymore by fermionic degrees of freedom. The low-energy excitations will actually be antiferromagnetic spin waves corresponding to these Goldstone modes. And if you want to give a correct description of the system, you better describe this transition from fermions, from electrons, to spin waves in a correct way, and the functional renormalization group, they should be a tool to go continuously really from one regime to the other regime. So let me conclude this first little motivation part. When we really want to come from the microscopic theory to the effective theory, we only sometimes have a situation where they are only distinguished by different values of the couplings. This is still not an easy thing, because we may have small couplings for the microscopic theory and non-perturbative couplings for the effective theory. But in addition, we often have also different degrees of freedom, and we definitely would like to have a method that can cope with all these situations. So functional renormalization group, in my view, is the method, or let's say it is at least a very powerful method that can describe the flow of the effective action as more and more fluctuations are included. So it is really giving the flow starting from the microscopic action at short distance scales, and then look at a larger and larger distance scales, and getting finally the reflective theory out. And perturbative renormalization is of course a special corner of this more wider scheme. Perturbative renormalization is simply the case where only the coupling changes, the couplings are small, collective degrees of freedom are not dominant. Now, how to deal with that? How to come, for example, from quarks and gluons to baryons and mesons, or from electrons to spin waves, and how to find now an effective degrees of freedom, an effective approach where the relevant of degrees of freedom can really depend on the momentum scale or on the scale of your resolution. So what you would need is, in principle, a type of microscope to look at your theory that has a variable resolution. So you start at short distances with a very high resolution, but you typically do not see the collective effects, and then as your resolution gets worse and worse, you integrate out fluctuations, but you start seeing the collective effects. And let me sketch that in this simple way. We have now to make this transition here. Of course, the problem that we have to deal when we come from microscopic to macroscopic physics, it's the role of the fluctuations. And if you want to do that continuously, what you want to do is to integrate out step by step the fluctuations. So first only the fluctuations with high momenta, and then as you lower your effective scale, you integrate out more and more of the fluctuations. There are of course many ideas how to do that. I mean, it's an old idea. I think it has started with the block spin approach by Kadanoff and Wilson. Then there have been a first formulation of exact renormalization group equations by Wilson, also by Wegner in Heidelberg, by Joe here. And of course, there are many similar related ideas. If you think about finite size scaling on lattice theories, for example, lattice gauge theories, is of course in principle perfectly the same idea. You just change the volume of your lattice and explore in this way longer and longer distances. The particular formulation I want to present you here is based on the so-called effective average action, which in a statistical physics sense is a type of coarse-grained free energy. So this is now enough of a motivation, and I want now to get immediately more to the method. Actually, before deriving you the exact flow equations, we will later derive exact flow equations and then discuss how to solve them in a reliable way. But before discussing the formal side, I want to give you a few results, relatively simple results, but that show you the power of this method. And I will do that for scalar field theories with a symmetry of On. So let's say sigma models, actually it describes linear and nonlinear sigma models. And I will do that for arbitrary dimension D and arbitrary N. So this describes a lot of things, for example, a sigma model for chiral symmetry breaking QCD or antiferromagnetic spin waves if the symmetry is O3. And you already may think immediately, well, depending on D and N, these models behave very similarly. Yeah? We have ordinary spontaneous symmetry breaking if D is 3 plus 1. We know that we have no symmetry breaking for non-abelian theory. If N is 2 or larger, we're in dimension 2. And then we have this very special case of a Kosterlitz-Bowles phase transition when the dimension is 2 and the number of components is 2, so when you have just U1 symmetry. And what I will pretend is there is one simple equation, one simple flow equation that deals with all these cases in a unique way. So you get a completely unique and unified picture for all these different cases, and you can even describe, for example, Kosterlitz-Bowles physics, which is normally thought to be highly non-perturbative physics of vortexes and vortex interactions, in a very simple linear scalar phi to the fourth theory. What you have to study mainly in this case is the flow of the effective potential. The effective potential is defined by just as the usual scalar potential, but now including all quantum fluctuations. So once you know the effective potential, you can immediately find the order parameter by looking where its minimum occurs. And the only difference that we make here with the effective potential, that this is as it is usually defined by a Legendre transform, the only difference we make here is that we do not include all fluctuations at once. So we introduce an additional infrared cutoff scale. This will be called K. And only in when we compute now the average potential, only fluctuations with Q squared bigger than K squared are included. So that tells you, oh, this green is really not visible. This tells you that when the infrared cutoff, when K is very large, we essentially do not include any fluctuations. So in this case, we start at some high scale where the potential is just the classical potential. And then when we lower K, we include more and more of the fluctuations, and we continuously flow to the effective potential from which we can read off the physical properties. So I've made here a sketch. So we start with an action that at short distances has just a classical potential, V of rho. Rho is just the squared of the field. So it looks like that, let's say. Typically, if you have only scalar fields, you have to start in the spontaneously broken regime in order to get anything interesting out. And now, as K is lowered, the shape of this potential changes continuously. It may either arrive at a potential where the minimum is at zero, then you have no order parameter. It may arrive at a situation where the minimum occurs in non-zero values. Actually, the potential gets then flat in between. This corresponds to spontaneous symmetry breaking, and then, of course, in the middle between those two is the phase transition that one is often interested in. So, what describes the flow of this potential? A very simple equation. An extremely simple equation for the scale dependence of this whole potential. So, obviously, this is a differential equation for a function U depending on two variables, the field variable phi and the scale chi, the scale k. And on the right-hand side, you see a simple one-loop formula a simple momentum integral, and you see a denominator that contains what will be the cutoff function and the full propagator. Let me just, before coming back to that, draw you a picture. So I pretend that the scale, the dependence of the potential on the scale, can be described by a simple one-loop equation. And this works, I remember you, this should work in a non-perturbative context, and I'm telling you, you will never need any higher loops. So it's a simple one-loop equation, which has a very simple interpretation. You have the full propagator, so in this case it has a kinetic term with a wave function renormalization. It has a mass term, and of course if you have several degrees of freedom, then you have here to sum over several particles going around in this loop. It has a mass term, and it has this infrared cutoff term. This infrared cutoff term, this is the piece that you add to your theory in order to cut off the fluctuation. And this is the piece that finally will go to zero when k goes to zero, such that all fluctuations are included. And now, since the only k dependence comes from this cutoff term, it is not surprising that when you take a k dependence of the potential, you get also a k dependence of your cutoff term. You get the insertion. So going back, we go back now to this simple formula. It's really this one-loop formula. You sum over all mass eigenvalues. In general, the mass eigenvalues, and this is, of course, now important, the mass matrix is given by the second derivative of the potential with respect to phi. And then the mass eigenvalues are just the eigenvalues of this matrix. What is crucial here is that this is not a fixed number. You have to evaluate this flow equation for arbitrary values of phi, so the mass term depends on phi. So this is, of course, really a full nonlinear differential equation for a function depending on two parameters. Little more to the infrared cutoff. In principle, there are different choices. For example, you can have an exponential cutoff, or you can have a cutoff that is effective only when q squared is smaller than k squared, and is just zero when q squared is bigger than k squared. Both of these cutoffs have actually the properties that when q squared is smaller than k squared, they just act like an additional mass term, just like a term k squared in the propagator. The general properties are always that when k goes to zero, the cutoff goes to zero. Of course, we do not want to have a theory with some remaining cutoff. And when k goes to infinity, this cutoff term should also go to infinity, such that no modes are included. We have a really effective infrared cutoff. The choice of the cutoff is free. You can use different cutoffs, and this will introduce a certain scheme dependence in your theory. Your exact results will, of course, not depend on the cutoff, but whenever you do any truncation, any approximation, you will find a residual cutoff dependence. This is one of the good tests, actually, for errors. Because you know that your true theory should not depend on the choice of the cutoff. Now, if you look at different cutoffs and you look how the results depend on the cutoff, this is very similar to, for example, the study of perturbation theory when you study the dependence on the renormalization scale or something like that. You can really judge from this unphysical scheme dependence how good you are. This is, of course, only one way, but it's already a very reasonable way to use just different cutoffs in order to see if your truncation is realistic or not. So now we have everything together. We have this flow equation, which is which couples the on the right hand side again the derivatives of the potential to the k dependence of the potential. We have this infrared cutoff. The only thing I didn't specify yet is this wave function renormalization here. It is given by k to the power minus eta, where eta is the anomalous dimension, and the anomalous dimension has to compute it separately. I may come back to that a little later. But if we just have that, then we have now this partial differential equation that we have to solve, and that's it. There is nothing more. First of all, it's important that we never have to specify now an independent regularization. This is very often a problem in both statistical and particle physics, that you have to define some ultraviolet regularization of your theory. This will never occur, simply because if your cutoff function Rk decays sufficiently fast for large q squared, then all your momentum integrations on the right-hand side are perfectly ultraviolet and infrared finite. This is a very important ingredient. Ultraviolet finite because the denominator decays, for example, exponentially, or it's even identically zero when q squared is bigger than k squared if you take this cutoff. So this cuts off the high momentum modes. The infrared singularities are regulated by this infrared cutoff in your effective propagator. For example, if the mass is zero, you still have a term proportional to k squared here, such that this integral is infrared finite. And this makes, of course, now numerical integration easily possible. You only have to specify your initial conditions at some high value of k, and then you run down, and actually, in a more mathematical sense, the exact flow equations define really a regularization scheme for your theory. There is a systematic way, and I will derive the systematic way in about 10 minutes. I was already announcing it comes from a functional equation, but I just thought it's better to get first a feeling for it and then to do the mathematics, which is not actually very difficult.
Can I ask again, how did you fix the exponent eta within this scheme?
If you want to compute eta, you have, of course, to go to compute now not only the potential, but you have a similar equation for the derivative term in the action. And this, of course, defines now the k dependence of your wave function renormalization, and from that you fix eta.
You need another equation.
I first present you the simplest thing, and I keep eta a little bit in my pocket. And of course, the full thing will be a functional differential equation for the full effective action, including all derivative terms. And you have to solve then for a given truncation, typically more than one function. But I will come to that in quite some detail.
Is this a function or is it a function?
At this place, it is a simple function. U is a simple function of phi. So image phi is really just the average of some field phi of x. Of course, this, if you look at it from the prospect of the full effective action, then the potential is simply the term that remains for constant fields. So this is, of course, where most of the physics is if you want to study the order parameter. So the effective potential is the part that applies for constant fields. And, of course, in this case, phi is just one variable. U is just a function of this variable, and also the eigenvalues are just functions of this variable. And at this level, you only have to make some input, because I wanted to include the anomalous dimension from the beginning, if you have this function zk. You may even actually not so badly approximate that with 1, and then you get an even self-contained equation. All these features that I'm discussing now for the effective potential will remain valid for the more complicated exact functional renormalization equation for the full effective action, but it's easier to visualize in the simple setting. Also, one thing, since we have already understood that it's this right hand side is ultraviolet and infrared finite, we can immediately realize that if you look really at this momentum integral, the integrand is peaked in a narrow range of momentum, namely around q squared, around k squared. So this is what, of course, we wish to have. We wish to have a situation that when we change the infrared cutoff infinitesimally, we just include an infinitesimal range of momenta in addition. So the right-hand side should really only involve the momenta around the scale k, and this is exactly what happens. It's just a smooth form of this, a smooth form where you have now not a delta function here, but an integrand that is highly peaked for momenta of the order of k squared. This is important when we look later at the reliability and the precision, because that tells you that at every scale k, you only, your flow is only sensitive to the physics at this scale k. This is, of course, very important. So it really decouples properly. Whenever you do a change in k, the right-hand side only involves the effective theory at this given scale k. And you have forgotten about what happens in the ultraviolet, and you do not need yet to know what happens in the infrared. Well, this is one of the real crucial ingredients, this property that makes this method so powerful. A little remark to the wave function renormalization. I answered already to the question, in principle you have to study the k-dependence of this coefficient of the kinetic term, and you have to, of course, compute an equation for it. Here I just I just take that as given, just as an input. Of course, I have computed it actually from some other equation, and I only want to make now one important remark: is here in this first approximation we take zk as a constant. If you allow zk to depend also on the field and on q squared, then the flow equation for the potential is actually an exact equation. So the only error in this equation comes from the fact that here we approximate the wave function renormalization by a constant. That already makes you guess that when the anomalous dimension is small, then of course the phi dependence and the q squared dependence of this function will be very moderate. And that we are already, by taking a constant set, we are really already quite near to the exact solution. Of course, I will show that this is an exact flow equation in a little later. Now we are almost at the result. There's one last thing. It is convenient to rescale all quantities with appropriate powers of k, such that we have only to deal with dimensionless functions. So the little u is the effective potential divided by k to the power d. Rho twiddle is the phi dagger phi, now properly scaled, also a renormalized quantity. And then if we have now u prime, it is a simple derivative of u with respect to rho twiddle. If we do that simple transformation, we also use t as the log of k, then we get this simple differential equation here for the ON symmetric scalar theory. The only thing that you cannot see, that at least I cannot see, is this threshold function L0d that appears here. This is, for example, for one of the cutoffs I've presented you, this is a simple explicitly known function, so there is some constants here, and the important dependence is 1 over 1 plus w, where w is the argument. And what you see now in the argument is actually the effective mass term, because the mass squared for the radial mode, this is u prime plus 2 rho times u double prime, and then there are the Goldstone modes where the mass term is simply u prime. So if you are sitting at the minimum, then the mass is exactly zero. And this is now, of course, a scaling form of the flow equation, and you may look for exact solutions where the potential does not run, so fixed point solutions. These have been found, and of course these fixed point solutions, they will now describe second order phase transitions, and you can directly look for the fixed point solutions. More efficient is actually just to solve the flow and to look where the phase transition occurs.
Sorry, I somehow lost things there. Could you remind me what rho is, please?
What?
Could you remind me what rho is?
Rho is just phi dagger, phi star phi. Just phi dagger phi, just because the potential by symmetry can only depend on phi. Just repeat it here. Rho is just, since I have it in a notion with n real components, so it is a sum from 1 to n of phi, it's just phi squared. Huh? And then you just rescale that. And the potential can, of course, only depend on this invariant.
And the equation in the box comes from the...
The equation in the box is simply the other equation that I have rescaled. I have rescaled it.
But I don't see the integral.
Well, the integral is solved. The q squared integral is now solved, and the q squared integral gives rise to these threshold functions here. And very often you can explicitly solve the q squared integral. And for example, this is the case when I have this particular threshold function here. This is just an explicit solution of the q squared integral. And this makes, of course, things easier because now you have not to integrate over q squared anymore. You get just explicit functions. And these threshold functions, they just contain the information on the q squared integral. And if you take actually now different cutoffs, you will in general get different threshold functions here. Okay? Since these functions are important, let me actually, it's still in green, let me actually discuss one crucial property of this threshold function. So it's a constant, and then it has this factor 1 over 1 plus w. So obviously these threshold functions that always appear on the right hand side, they vanish when w gets large. And w is nothing else than the mass squared in units of k squared. So that tells you whenever we are in a situation where the masses are large compared to k, then the corresponding modes effectively decouple from the flow equation. So you have here a very simple realization of decoupling. You never have to put it in. Heavy modes that have masses larger than k simply decouple effectively through these threshold functions, whereas when the mass is smaller than k, then w is essentially zero, and you just have these threshold functions just get constants. This is, of course, already very useful, because this is one step when we want to get effective theories. One step is to get rid of unnecessary heavy degrees of freedom once they decouple. This is done in a simple way. For that, we will not have to do any particular effort. We just run, and then we just get essentially zero contributions from all the modes that have masses that are larger than k squared.
But the mass squared depended on phi, right?
The mass squared depended on phi. Effectively, of course, if you are a bit studying it closer, you have to, the condition for decoupling is that the mass term for arbitrary phi is larger than k squared. This is not a problem, because usually when you go out, the potential, the mass term even increases.
But w doesn't depend on phi?
W depends on phi, of course. W, the argument, I mean, this makes the equation, as you see, the phi dependence. Here, this is actually just canonical dimension and anomalous dimensions here. This is a trivial part. The real evolution of the equation, the real physics, comes here from this radial, from this loop involving the radial mode and the n minus 1 Goldstone modes. And you see that the rho dependence of this whole equation just comes through these threshold functions here. Okay? So, now we are there. Now we have this simple equation. We must admit it's really for for all the things it should do. It is really an incredibly simple equation, no? Just some dimension scaling, and then a loop, an expression for the loop of the radial mode and for the n minus 1 Goldstone modes, and that's it. You have it explicitly. You can just put it on a computer, and you do that. Put it on a computer, choose your n, choose your d, choose an initial form of the potential, and you run. And here you have a few results. First result is Ising model. Well, that's of course a simple thing to study. I've shown that here because you see what happens actually to this potential. These lines here correspond to different k. So when you start out with large k, typically the minimum of the potential occurs somewhere outside here, and the height of the potential is high, in the middle is high. And then as k is lowered, the height comes down and the minimum moves inside. And for these particular initial values that correspond to non-zero symmetry breaking, you find that from a certain value of k on, the outside part of the potential does not change anymore. Only the inside part goes actually continuously to a flat potential, which is of course nice because we know that the total potential must be convex. And here it's really realized by the fluctuations. But this is the general scheme how it happens. If we would be in the symmetric phase, then the minimum would just flow to zero, and then the flow would also stop at some moment. So this gives you qualitatively, so this was of course now really a phi to the four potential to start with. There's absolutely no limitation to start with a phi to the four potential. You can go, for example, to very realistic potentials for concrete systems. I did it here for carbon dioxide. So you have the short distance potential given by some virial coefficients that you take out from the literature. You start it and you flow. And what you find is, for example, this type of endpoint of the critical line of the phase transition. And you can now really compute numbers, compare with experiment, and it works. It really works. I mean, it's really something where you can explicitly now make the transition from short-distance physics to macroscopic physics. Yes?
And this is all for potentials which somehow grow?
They grow when phi goes to infinity. That's a typical characteristic. But they often have, they have at short distances already a shape of spontaneous symmetry breaking because the tendency of scalar fluctuations is to destroy order.
So there are other kinds of problems where you could have going to a constant at large distances, and then
you could of course also do that.
This would probably change dramatically.
We have, for example, at some moment I was interested in Liouville's theory, so I've studied an exponential potential that goes just e to the phi, so it goes to zero on one side and infinity to the other side. You can apply that perfectly. There is no a priori limitation to that.
I'm just concerned that your equations might explode if you...
Well, for the examples we have studied so far, they never have exploded. I'm not telling you that it will never explode. For example, if you would have a potential that is really, that is unstable, you may suddenly get into problems.
E to the minus phi squared repulsive.
E to the minus phi squared, I have no idea. E to the power minus phi I've studied, but e to the power...
I want something which decays in all directions.
As long as it goes to constant, it's probably fine. When it really goes to minus infinity, then you get probably into trouble. This is my experience. I know that, for example, people have studied sine-Gordon potentials, so sinus and things like that. So there is a priori really no limitation if your potential is stable.
This would, for instance, describe self-aligning polymers. Directly on the polymer.
I did not try everything, but from my experience, I see no problem unless the potential really goes to minus infinity when phi grows large. And then, of course, since we have now done, let's say, the Ising model or CO2, we may directly read off the critical exponents. You start just run at different temperatures. And you look what happens, for example, to your correlation length or to your order parameter is a function of temperature. So there is no additional computation involved here. You just read off from your numerical results how the different quantities depend on temperature. And what you find are critical exponents that are really competitive. Here I give you the exponent nu for the correlation length for different values of n. Note that we have even n equals 0, so you can also use it for the replica trick. You compute nu. These are the values you find, and what I have quoted here, world, these are averages. This is an effective average. Of course, you should not take it in this way. I will come to it a bit more clearly. For many other methods, I come in the next transparency set. You can also do it for eta. Eta is a little less good than nu for reasons that are well understood.
Yeah, can this be systematically improved? I mean, at some point you made an approximation.
Yes, yeah. It can be systematically improved. And actually what I have presented you is just the lowest order of a derivative expansion. The next order in the derivative expansion really takes now wave function renormalization that depends not on q squared, but depends on rho. So then you include two derivatives. And then the next order would be having up to four derivatives. So actually, the lowest order in the derivative expansion that I have discussed with you in detail gives you very reasonable values, but the bit somewhat more precise values I've presented on the last transparencies are already second order in the derivative expansion, where you still have this field-dependent wave function renormalization that you take into account. And by now there are even people that have gone to fourth order in the derivative expansion, and I have here taken this transparency from a talk by Bervilliers. This is Canet, de la Motte, and Muhanna and Vidal. So they have really now zeros order, second order, two derivatives and four derivatives. And you see that this series really converges. And on the right-hand side, you see here all sorts of high-precision things, like, for example, 25-order high-temperature series, or Monte Carlo, high-precision Monte Carlo, or seventh order field theory that you can do in three dimensions. All these precision values really lie very well, are already reached to relatively good precision in second order in the derivative expansion. Even here, from lowest to second order, it's only a relatively small change. I mean, you just get at once already the right ballpark, and then you start fiddling a little bit. And actually, you can do much better than the derivative expansions. There are better expansions that people are probing now. And I guess if you do these better expansions, it will converge even much faster, because after all, we know the propagator is not q squared plus q to the 4, but it rather goes like q squared with some anomalous dimension. And if you put that in, then it will converge much, much faster.
Let me again play devil's advocate, because this is for a theory where you know the perturbative calculations work extremely well. So your method is close to this expansion, and your outset was to give a method which is applicable in
that is not true. Context. This is not true, because you can do perturbative expansion, or for example epsilon expansion, but very often, for example, the epsilon expansion, the series are not really converging. If you just take the series by themselves, they need really highly sophisticated Pardee resummations in order to come to these results. Well, but you are not close to a perturbative expansion. This is what I will tell you, because you just get it here at once. And I will give you in a short while an example where perturbation theory just gives nothing and you get a result. So really, in this case that it converges so well is actually linked to the smallness of eta. Here you can directly trace it. But it has nothing to do with couplings are always large. And the coupling constant is not a good expansion.
What do you mean by close to the perturbative, aren't you? I mean your operator constant.
Yeah, your operator content. You do not have. You do not need collective modes here, for example. This is if this makes it, of course, simpler. But I will give you other examples where we deal with collective modes. You can do the same thing for ITER. Again, you find a very reasonable convergence to the results, and you never have to go to very high orders. Now,
just coming back
to Kai's question, this was something where you would say, okay, at least qualitatively, we know that in three dimensions, we do not need any new degrees of freedom. But what happens now, let's say, in two dimensions? So we just change a parameter in your flow, in our flow equations, and run them again. In two dimensions, you know that, for example, if n equals 2, you expect the Kosterlitz-Saulus phase transition. That is usually described by vortices and then by unbinding of vortices through vortex-vortex interactions. So what happens here? We just run it, and what we find are a Kosterlitz-Saulus transition. For example, here I have plotted the correlation length, this is the inverse of the renormalized mass, as a function of temperature. Essential scaling should give this very particular form, exponent minus b over t minus tc to 1/2, when t is bigger than tc. Well, here I have plotted the relative, the log of the mass such that we should get a linear slope. That's what we find. So just directly, this is again actually second order derivative expansion, you just plot it, what comes out, you see essential scaling. You also see the low temperature phase in a very simple way. So you find that the low temperature phase is actually a phase with a Goldstone boson. So this accounts for the long correlation length, for the infinite correlation length in the low temperature phase of Kosterlitz, of the Kosterlitz-Saulus phase transition. And if you look closer, you find that you actually get also a type of renormalized order parameter that is different from zero. So the bare order parameter, so this rho that we have defined here, this will go to zero, but then the renormalized order parameter, wave function renormalization times rho, this will actually go to a constant. And I have shown you here a result for the two-dimensional Hubbard model, doped Hubbard model, now not in the antiferromagnetic regime, which is, of course, at long distances, now not described by antiferromagnetic waves, but D wave superconductivity that corresponds in the long distance region to a scalar theory with a U1 symmetry. And here you typically find how this renormalized order parameter runs. So when you are below the temperature, it actually is zero. You start in the symmetric phase here. The fermion fluctuations drive it to a non-zero value. And then the Goldstone boson fluctuations drive it to zero if your temperature is smaller than the critical temperature. When you go below the, if your temperature is larger than the critical temperature. If you go to larger temperatures, then your order parameter certainly does not run anymore. So you really have a phase with spontaneous symmetry breaking. The curve is actually here, then the critical temperature is defined such that the macroscopic scale corresponds to 1 centimeter, but these details will again essentially be independent of these details. And if you plot now the renormalized order parameter or correspondingly also the electron gap delta in, for the Hubbard model, what you find is really this type of degrees when t goes to tc, and then you have this jump. This is what is called the jump in the renormalized superfluid density, It's normally a universal quantity in the vortex picture. Here you get it out, and numerically it actually agrees up to 10% in this approximation to the value that is usually quoted. You can also compute the critical exponent eta in the low temperature phase. It depends on the critical temperature, as it should be, and is close to 1/4 where it should be at the critical temperature. So without any additional effort, you get all these features out. I hope that this convinces you that it's much more than perturbation theory here. I mean, this coupling, solving this coupled equation where you have all this interest, all this very straightforward physical intuition, you just have to find a good qualitative approximation to the functional form of your propagator, is really very powerful. Yeah? You get really different branches of physics with one and the same equation. Convergence and errors, I think I have already discussed it a little bit. For example, you may study some systematic expansions and then just look how the results depend on the order of the expansion. You may look how results depend on the choice of the cutoff, because this gives you effectively different trajectories in function space when you run from microphysics to macroscopic physics. You may also just test some additional terms in your truncation of the most general form, functional form of the propagator. Look what are its influence. There are actually indeed methods to study errors, even though this is probably the part that is that is the least developed. You usually do not find error bars on these quantities. I just have given you at some moment the error bars when you compare second and fourth order in the derivative expansion. But this is not something that cannot be done. And there are a lot of studies, for example, on the scheme dependence and so on, and studying errors. So now I've talked for 1 hour. Shall we make a break before I come to the formal part? This is perhaps not a bad idea. We make a short break, and then I derive in the next part the exact functional differential equation, discuss different systematic expansions, and then come back to the fermions, how to include fermions, and discuss the collective degrees of freedom. So this will be the rest of the program. Okay? How long do we make a break?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. This gives you a chance to get your ammunition ready to to shoot now a bit on this equation. No? Okay, now I promise you to derive the exact functional flow equations. This is actually not very difficult, so I can prove, well, I can at least give you the basic ideas in only a few transparencies. I do not want to be too mathematical. The quantity you start with is the log of the partition function, so the generating functional for the connected Green's functions, here again for a scalar theory, so chi is now the microscopic scalar field, functional integral over it, here you have the action, you have your source terms, and the only thing you add here is an additional piece to the action.
The source is coupled to fermion fields?
Here chi is still scalar field. I'm still discussing in the scalar context, but when you go to fermions, you will do the same and have sources coupled to the fermions. So.
And this is already a cross-range object, right? I mean, if you think in terms of your example of the carbon dioxide, I mean,
think of a binary mixture. I mean, these quantities are already cross-range quantities, so.
Yeah, of course, the notion, what is microscopic, is of course something that is relative. But the idea here, you start with some scale, k to infinity or k very large, and at this scale, somebody tells you what is your microscopic theory. Wherever this comes again in a higher level, but you need some starting point. So this is your classical action, and the model that you want to solve is, of course, what happens when you do not have this color term. Then it's just a standard partition function, standard free energy. And the only thing you do now, you add a cutoff term. This cutoff term green should really be eliminated from this beamer. This cutoff term is quadratic in the fields, and it involves so it's a momentum integral, quadratic in the fields, and then it has this cutoff function Rk of q squared here. And the cutoff function we have already discussed. So when Rk goes to infinity, it cuts off all fluctuations, and this can be, of course, simply solved. Only the classical piece really contributes, and otherwise, when k goes to zero, this is the final theory, including now all thermal and quantum fluctuations. Now, once you have this k-dependent generating function for the connected rings functions, you can easily go by a Legendre transform to the effective action that is now the coarse-grained free energy, and this generates the one-particle irreducible rings functions. So phi is now, of course, a function of x. It's not a constant anymore. It is now a full field. And gamma k effectively includes now all fluctuations with q squared, because in k squared, gamma lambda specifies the microphysics. So this is now a more general thing. You can not only have a potential, you can also have much more complicated kinetic terms and so on. And when k goes to zero, we get again the full solution. Notice that just formally, phi, the argument here, is given by the derivative of this k-dependent generating function with respect to the sources. So this is the quantity you want to solve. Actually, see, it's not only a Legendre transform, but I have re-subtracted here the cutoff term now as a function of phi. This is because we do not want to have always this unphysical cutoff term explicitly present in the effective action, so we subtract it here. And then you can, for example, simply see that if you take the one-loop expansion of that, you get the one-loop with a cutoff function in the propagator. Now, what we want to do is now to solve that for k going to zero in order to include all quantum and thermal fluctuations. And for that purpose, we derive an exact denormalization of equation. And this actually has, if you remember the form of the potential, it has exactly the same form. It's only a more complicated object. So it contains here a flow of the average action. But the average action is now not a simple function of phi, it is a functional of phi. So there are arbitrarily high derivatives, arbitrarily complicated momentum dependences here in this effective average action. But the right-hand side still has this simple one-loop structure. So the right-hand side still has the exact propagator. So the exact propagator obtains by the second functional derivative of the effective action with respect to phi. So here this is, of course, a matrix in momentum space and in internal space. And then it's multiplied by the k derivative of the cutoff function, and you have to take a trace. Trace means momentum integration and summation over internal indices. That's it. And this equation now is exact. So there are no corrections. It's a one-loop equation, and it's exact. It becomes exact by the fact that we look only at the k derivative, and that we always that we do not have some, let's say, bare propagator here, but that we always have on the right-hand side the full propagator standing that depends on k and on phi. Yes?
So I wanted to understand that in more detail. So if this is exact, then gamma k is a functional of phi, but the phi that goes in there should be something with the high Fourier components that you've already
This is just a function of phi of x, or equivalently to phi of q. So it contains the high Fourier modes and the low Fourier modes. And this is actually very convenient, but because what you will find is the part that contains only the high momentum modes will actually not change with k anymore. So when you at a given k, when you lower k, you only involve, the only change in the effective action concerns the low Fourier modes. But your high Fourier mode, they're already frozen in. So for example, if you want to study the high momentum behavior of your theory, it's all contained here. You never lose information. That's very different from the type of block spin. You never lose information. You have still the full information on your high momentum modes. The only thing that happens is for the high momentum modes, you have an effective running until k reaches this momentum scale, and then their interactions are frozen. But this makes, of course, now a simple transition, a simple full picture for high and low momentum modes. At the end, you just get the free energy function for all modes.
And gamma 2 can include not just second derivatives, but the full.
No, gamma 2 is really second function.
Spatial derivatives.
Whatever your momentum dependence is, of course it has arbitrary, you can have very complicated lattice propagators, for example, or whatever it is. Whatever is your second functional derivative appears here. And of course the second functional derivative for arbitrary space-dependent and time-dependent background fields may be complicated. So it has a simple structure, but it's still a complicated differential equation. Okay, now how to derive that? This is a four-line proof. I do not want to go through it. It's simple functional manipulations. I think at this point you can just believe me that it's not something complicated, and it can be done in a very straightforward way. And whenever your functional integral is well defined, then all these things have a well-defined meaning. For example, if you regularize it on a lattice or something like that, a priori, in order to make all quantities well-defined, all these quantities have here very definite meaning, and what comes out after a little calculation is this exact flow equation. Actually, I must admit that I have studied this this powerful equation for the effective potential already a couple of years before I finally found that this was just a limiting case for an exact equation. So in this case, somehow history went backwards. I was just surprised that the results always came out so good, and I think let's try to derive it as an exact equation, and that is how it finally went. So it's not complicated once you know the study, the object you want to study. But of course, the result is a functional differential equation. It has this very intuitive physical form and this very big advantage that it's a simple one-loop expression. It never has anything more complicated like that. It has, for example, no tree diagram contributions as Joe's equations. And it has an explicit infrared cutoff whenever you work with it, which makes, of course, computations really doable, because your right-hand side is always well-defined. It has always only this small momentum range. But it's still a complicated functional differential equation, because it's a complicated object, and it's a complicated object.
Can you remind us, when you say Joe's equation, that's a version for W? Or?
That's essentially a version for W, and therefore it contains, it's a version for the connected Green's function, and therefore it contains three diagrams. And the problem is also, of course, in a certain sense, that when you go when you have massless modes, for example, you know that your W itself is a complicated functional because it gets non-localities. They are partly taken off by Judicious choice of the fields, but nevertheless the physics problems often remain from that. So it's just a much simpler quantity in a sense, because we have an intuitive feeling what the effective action does, whereas we have very little intuitive feeling what the generating function really does. It's just a more complicated function, and that's why it's, in my view, much easier to work with this. But of course, all these exact functional differential equations are, of course, you know, equivalent to each other. There's only one generating function at the end, and by suitable mathematical transformations, you can come from one to the other. Even these transformations are often Legendre transforms, so they are simple in to write them down. They're very complicated, unfortunately, in practice. So it's actually not so easy to go then in practice really from one version to the other.
Have you tried going to higher?
I went up to two particle irreducible. This can be done. I've done that, yes.
Does this give anything interesting?
It's not yet known. So far, no, really. I mean it seriously. So far, the computations with one particle irreducible are relatively simple. Two-particle irreducible, you then need, you know, not a functional only of fields, but a functional of propagators. And these are more complicated objects. So for simple cases, you can easily do it. I'm not sure that it really brings an advantage. This is the present status. But it can be formulated, and it has been formulated. So now comes the important question, truncations, because this will of course decide on the fate of and on the success of this whole approach. Functional differential equation, usually it's just impossible to solve it. So we need approximations, and finding approximations are simply done by making an ansatz on the form of the effective action that you want to consider. At this point, you have to put in physics. It's not so universal that physics never appears. You have to think carefully, to make a careful guess, what is the general form of the effective action that you want to make, because if your truncation does not really contain, let's say, an important physics feature, then it will give you a nonsense result. So you can only solve it approximately, and the approximation, the crucial step is finding the right truncation, and your success, if it works or works not, depends if you can find a good truncation or not. So this is coming back to the discussion we had in the break. There is no a priori guarantee that it always works. But when you have a truncation that really has a physical solution that is not too far from the physical solution at the end, even though it allows free functions and so on that have to be determined later, then you have very good chances that it works. So truncations can be done either by guessing and then checking if you have the physics. There are also some ways of doing systematic expansions. For example, you can make a derivative expansion. That is what we have discussed for the scalar theory. You have a potential, then the next term, the derivative expansion, will contain two derivatives. For the ON symmetric scalar theory, you have actually two additional functions here, because you have different kinetic terms for the Goldstone and for the radial modes, and you can go down to fourth order. Another expansion is an expansion in powers of fields. This is, of course, now an expansion in 1PI vertices. Has been done a lot for fermions, this has been actually this gives you now a coupled system of flow equations for one particle irreducible vertices, which has been first discussed by Steve Weinberg, actually, even though he didn't really exploit it, but the first form where it was written down is actually due to C. So this is a powerful method, actually, another powerful expansion. This will break down when higher order vertices play an important role. There are even more expansions that have been tried. For example, you may expand in the canonical dimension of couplings. Very often you can
get good results if you go only up to dimension zero operators. So for example, in three dimension, the operators will be the mass term, or let's say the location of the minimum, the quartic coupling, and then we need a cubic coupling and the wave function renormalization. So with a four-parameter approximation, in this case, you get very often already quite good results. And then you can try polynomial expansions, for example. And what has been found is when your potential has a minimum, that you get usually a very fast convergence of a polynomial expansion if you expand around the minimum. If you expand around the origin and the minimum is at non-zero values, then your expansion usually is not particularly convincing. So these are different expansions, and now let's also make the bridge to the flow equation for the potential. So the exact flow equation for the potential is now easily obtained. The only thing we have to do, since we have in general, if you go back to the derivative expansion, if we want to get a flow equation only for the part that does not contain any derivative, well, we just have to evaluate the effective action for constant fields. Because for constant fields, this right-hand side and higher derivatives are all zero. So if we evaluate the effective action for constant fields, we immediately get an exact flow equation for the potential. And the right-hand side involves now simply the exact propagator. You have it again. It involves the exact propagator in presence of a constant background field. If you have a good approximation to this exact propagator, then you are definitely in business, because it's just an exact equation. Okay. Now, I do not want to continue with scalars too long. I want to come also to fermions and composite decays of freedoms. Let me just mention that models with several fields of over programs and so on have been studied. Phase structures, relatively complicated phase structures like helium 3 come out. The replica trick for n equals 0 gives reliable, gives good results. And for example, recently the shift in the critical temperature for the Bose-Einstein condensate. Bosonic atoms has been studied by Lesseau and collaborators. This needs now a better resolution for the momentum dependence of the propagator. But again, it's agreeing with all what we know, for example, on the shift on the critical temperature. The models have been, the same methods have been applied to gauge theories, even to gravity. Martin Reuter.
When you say that the phase structure of helium 3, you mean all the phases, the crystalline?
Crystalline, but the phases, a lot of the phases with continuous order parameters.
The liquid phases
in helium 3 have been studied. It's already pretty complicated, and already just to get all this phase diagram is not trivial, and it came out quite well. Now, disorder systems, which is the. Yes?
Okay, maybe you're about to answer my question, but I wanted to ask, when you say replica trick there, you mean for polymers rather than for.
For polymers in this case. In this case, for polymers, for example, N models where you can just take N to zero. So it's nice that it works. I mean, this type of continuation can be done. So more general disordered systems, I'm not the expert, or at least maybe I want to get an expert here, but this is usually not going as fast, so I have to learn a little bit, or quite a lot actually. But there are some people in France who applied it to disordered systems, and at least from what they tell me, it works at least for some of the systems, perhaps not for all. I have no real judgment, but it's not that you cannot apply it. I mean, sometimes, for example, you get, of course, then kinetic terms you get that are more complicated or things like that. I'm not going to do that today, since this is not my field of experience. I rather want to include now fermions, and the basic message is fermions do not pose any particular problem. So it's not like, let's say, fermions on the lattice, where you have sign problems or something like that.
that. Here, fermions can just be dealt with exactly in the same way. The only thing that you find is that the loop contribution gets a relative minus sign, which is, of course, what you expect from Grassmann fields. Otherwise, there's just nothing new. So let's now try to apply it in order to convince you that you can get results, and the results for theories where collective degrees of freedom play a role. Let's apply it to a system that is much discussed. Recently, ultra-cold atom gases for fermionic atoms. This is, of course, one of the real interesting developments in recent times, and it's actually quite convenient for me because last week I was at MIT, and besides a physics colloquium on cosmology, I've given a talk in the Center for Ultra-Cold Atoms in Ketterle's seminar on this, so I could just use this material for here, and I think it's quite interesting what comes out. So just to give you a glance on the physics, this is famous Bose-Einstein condensate ECS crossover physics. So when you have bound molecules of two atoms on a microscopic scale and they are tightly bound and you cool the system down, you expect that these molecules, these are bosons, that they simply condense. So two fermionic atoms form a di-atom state, a molecule, and a low temperature physics of bosonic particles is the Einstein condensate. On the other side, when you have no bound molecule, let's say, or whenever molecules play no role in the microscopic physics, but you still have attractive interactions for the fermions, you expect Cooper pairs, and then you expect ECS superfluidity at low temperature. And then you can now consider a smooth crossover from this situation to this situation, and that is usually realized by a Feshbach resonance as a function of magnetic field. I suppose that the main physics of you is known to most of you, so let's immediately go to really how to attack this problem by functional renormalization and give you the results. And first I want to get you oriented a little bit in parameter space. So the crossover can be relatively easily described if you, for those not familiar to it, you use in practice what you do, you use your magnetic field in order to change your effective scattering length. There is a point when the scattering length is positive. This corresponds to the BEC phase. When the scattering length is negative, this is the BCS phase. And then there's a crossover in between where the scattering length diverges. So what is plotted here is the inverse scattering length. And on the other axis, I've plotted the chemical potential in appropriate units. So when you are in the BCS phase, in the fermionic phase, it's positive. And when you go to the Bose-Einstein condensate phase, it's negative, as it should be. So this is this type of crossover physics where you come smoothly from BCS to BEC. And we may look at this curve plotted in a little bit different way. So here it is again. Now putting really labels on the axis. First of all, I've subtracted a simple term from the effective chemical potential, which is nothing else than the molecular binding energy when you're in the BEC phase. Now, this is just in order to normalize your curve such that when you go far to the BEC phase, your chemical potential actually goes to zero. This is just subtracting a trivial term, but you see easier the crossover. Now, what is plotted here, now in order to get numbers, is a parameter called concentration, or the inverse of it, which is the concentration is just the scattering length multiplied with the Fermi momentum. And what is plotted on the upper axis is the effective chemical potential, mu defined, divided by the Fermi energy. And of course, Fermi energy and Fermi momentum are related in the usual way. But we have plotted here again. Now you see this curve, you cannot resolve it very well. It's various versions with the mean field theory, and you see, for example, the black ones are the results of functional renormalization. But before going, let's look at this concentration parameter a little bit in more detail. So it is scattering length times Fermi momentum. So in a sense, it's something like scattering length in units of the average distance between atoms. So if this parameter is small, then you have effectively a weakly interacting system, or let's say it's better to say that we have a dilute system. When this concentration parameter is large, you have a dense system. Of course, in order to compute this concentration parameter, you need the density. You need density because from the density you need the density in order to extract the Fermi momentum, which is defined in this way. So we have now on both sides the dilute system, and in the middle, the difficult part will be the dense system, where the effective coupling actually diverges. This curve is at temperature zero, I forgot to say it before. Now we can compare different methods. I give you again results first, and then describe a little later how you get it. So there is mean field and Schwinger-Dyson equations, and we get now for this curve the functional renormalization induced as a Monte Carlo point exactly at infinite scattering length and zero temperature. No, comes out not so badly. This is not a complicated truncation. No? It's just a couple of percent different from the quantum Monte Carlo curve, where his mean field and Schwinger-Dyson equations are substantially higher. Now, how to get this? How to come also to more complicated quantities? It's again the same, very similar system that we can study. We can study a system that contains now fermionic degrees of freedom. It's again non-relativistic. The Hamiltonian is just a kinetic term for the fermions. And I've added here molecule degrees of freedom, also non-relativistic. They have, of course, twice the mass, so kinetic, the Hamiltonian has now kinetic term for fermions, kinetic term for molecules. And then there is a relative binding energy between those two. This is this parameter nu. This is just a shift in energy between a bound molecule and two free atoms. And then we have, as usual, the chemical potential. That is subtractic, and it's twice, it's two times the chemical potential for the bosons. Now, this would be just two separate systems. You have to couple them, and this is done by a type of Yukawa coupling, and in this alpha cold atom community, it's often called Feschbach coupling. And you see you get an effective or fermion interaction that comes by the exchange of these molecules. It's very simple for a particle physicist. This is just a Yukawa type theory, very simple theory. As usual, time is on a is Euclidean on the torus with circumference 1 over t. That's how the temperature comes in. Now, what are the parameters? The parameters are so-called detuning, which relate this shift between atoms and the two atom states and molecule states to the magnetic field. Actually, this is a quantity that gets quadratically renormalized, that gets renormalized. That's why it is not vanishing when b is equal to b0, but it has an offset. What is important is that the derivative with respect to b, this is just board magneton that can be easily computed. So this one parameter. The second parameter is this Yukawa or Feschbach coupling. Now, since this action that we had before was purely quadratic in
from quadratic and linear in the molecule field, we can of course easily derive an effective action that is expressed only in terms of fermionic atom fields. Well, we can integrate phi out, it's a Gaussian integral, and then we define the effective equivalent fermionic action, which gets now just from this vertex here, a four-fermion interaction, which is, however, in general not local. You have here the cover coupling square, and then you have the propagator for phi, which has this tuning term here, chemical potential, but then it has also the kinetic energy of the molecules and the temperature dependent. So it's in general not a local theory, but our Yukawa type theory describes all effective interactions that have this form of momentum dependence for the propagator. There's a simple limit, this is the low momentum limit, and in the low momentum limit, this is difficult to see, maybe you can still see, in the low momentum limit you can neglect these terms here such that a local interaction remains. And actually, and that is how you define your scattering length. You define an effective four fermion coupling by just taking h squared divided by mu, and the scattering length is then simply related to this four fermion interaction. Now there's an interesting limit. This is actually why I put this fermionic language, because when you have a Broad resonance, then you can take the limit where the Yukawa coupling gets large and this new lambda gets large, and nevertheless the four fermion interaction remains constant. And in this limit you see that these terms here completely become negligible, and you end with a local four fermion interaction. So the local four fermion interaction is just a limiting case of this more general form of interactions between atoms and molecules. I tell you that because this gives now an easy way of introducing collective states in your flow. Because we could have started with a purely fermionic interaction, with purely four fermion interaction, and just introduce these collective degrees of freedom, these molecules, by partial bond ionization. Since we have seen that this is one-to-one equivalent, and this can be done, for example, by a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation formally. This does not mean that our system always describes physical bound states, microscopic bound states. This type of introducing the collective fields for diatom states can be just also considered as a formal tool, and the interpretation of this of the meaning of this field phi really is actually quite different if you are on the BEC side, on the BCS side. On the BEC side, it can really be interpreted as physical bound states because there's already microscopic binding, whereas on the BCS side, they really describe the Cooper pairs. And the lesson is, if you want to introduce collective degrees of freedom, in a sense, you introduce auxiliary fields for the type of collective degrees of freedom that you want to consider. There are methods of introducing them smoothly, to which I will come a little later. But I first want to solve this problem. So first, units and dimensions. Of course, particle physics always takes E and H bar to 1, the Boltzmann constant also. That means momentum length. The momentum is the inverse length, mass is electron volt. Now, what is different from these systems to many things that you may often find is that energies actually are measured in units of the Fermi energy. So energies, the energy unit is actually twice the moment, the mass of the atom times the energy of the atom, and this has dimension momentum squared. So there is typical momenta are measured in units of the Fermi momentum. Typical energies, temperature, are measured in units of the Fermi energy. And this implies that time has now the dimension of momentum to the power minus 2 and gives a canonical dimension
that is different from relativistic quantum field theory. So the action, even though we are in 3 plus 1 dimension, the Lagrangian has now dimension 5, actually, in this unit, and all the canonical scaling has to be adopted properly. Yeah, I was already. Now, if you use this, you can rescale your action by appropriate powers of Fermi momentum and Fermi scale, and you end at an action that has now no unit where the mass of the atoms drops out completely, as it should be. And you can, for example, if you choose just the scale to be the Fermi scale, you can immediately express all parameters in units of the Fermi momentum. So, this was just to define your theory. Now, you have to truncate. You have now, again, to go to this formalism, introduce the effective action, and we will have to truncate the effective action, and I use here a very simple truncation. The truncation keeps essentially the same form as we had before for the effective action, with two differences. First, the potential is now not just quadratic in phi, it is a general function of phi, so, and the kinetic, the gradient terms here, get additional constants. Also, the fields here already renormalized fields, so the wave function renormalization is already taken out. Otherwise, you get the wave function renormalization of the fermions and the bosons in addition. And now we have just a few quantities, these A psi, A phi, the Dukawa coupling that depend on K, and then we have one function that depends on K that one can even actually quite well approximate by a polynomial in this case. So that's all. Very simple approximation, and you can just run it and look at the results. Here's, for example, the gap parameter, the gap for the single atom excitations in the low temperature phase. So it's again temperature zero as a function of concentration. And again, it agrees quite well with the Monte Carlo result. I mean, this is really a genuine strong coupling problem. And to get it right is far from trivial, in that already in this very simple approximation, you get it relatively quantitatively correctly. Is far from being trivial. It simply tells you that you have the right degrees of freedom and your approximation is not too bad. Actually, the limits are also interesting, because if you look at the gap, now even so we have now formulated as a type of Yukawa theory, when we come to the BCS side, the gap really approaches the BCS gap as it should be, which is at first sight, not completely trivial, because it's a completely different computation that you do when you do BCS physics, and you just approach it on this side. There's another curve, the red curve, which is also an interesting curve. This is the renormalized order parameter, so this rho that we had here, phi star phi in this case, but with a wave function renormalization. This describes actually the condensate fraction. And again, if you go to So the number of atoms that are in the condensate, either both the Einstein condensate or superfluid condensate on the BCS side, and if you go here on this side to the both the Einstein condensate, you come actually to the form that you get in a purely interacting bosonic theory with a scattering length of 0.98. So here you see directly how you can effectively change degrees of freedom, first of all as a function, of course, of your concentration, but also as a function of K, because if you start, for example, on this side here, then in the microscopic theory, there's absolutely no trace of molecules, so the molecules actually do not play a role. And then you run for a long time, where you have formally your contributions for molecules, but in practice your molecule contribution is essentially zero. And then when you come to the rate, to the momentum scale, where the Cooper pairs form, then this momentum scale corresponds now to the scale from which on the molecule fluctuations play an important role. And where the fermion fluctuation actually ceases to be important. And in this form, you can really shift continuously from one sort of degrees of freedom to another sort of degrees of freedom. You may also look, for example, at the temperature dependence of the condensate. Also an interesting curve. So you have here T over TC, here you have the condensate fraction. And look only at the, I've only sketched them here roughly. So what you find here is you have the blue curve is just a free Bose-Einstein condensate. So this is a very trivial curve. Then you have the red curve, where the concentration is 1, so you're still on the BEC side, and this is actually pretty close to the free Bose-Einstein condensate. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty close. And then you have the strongly interacting case, when the concentration is infinity, and you see substantial deviations. Still, when you come to the critical temperature here, you see that all this curve comes to 1. And this is, of course, now something that we already know. This is universal critical behavior. Since near the critical temperature, we expect that it's just an O2 symmetric sigma model, which has a given universality class, and you break out of that on this limit. So all what I have told you before is actually directly applicable here, because in this region here, near the critical temperature, the fermions do not play a role in the final flow to long distances. You get the universal behavior here. Now, I went quite a long time, so let me flash. Are you still ready for 5 minutes? Okay, then I tell you a little bit more about changing degrees of freedom, because this is actually an interesting topic by itself. We have already seen a little bit, a first glance, how we could start with a purely fermionic theory and then end up with a bosonic theory. This is, for example, what will be important also for the Hubbard model. For antiferromagnetism, we start with electrons, and we end with the physics of antiferromagnetic spin waves. And I wanted to discuss this topic of changing degrees of freedom a little bit more. And I do it now by the antiferromagnetic order in the Hubbard model. I will be a bit briefer because we are already late in time. Hubbard model has already been introduced, so I just repeat it. And the only difference as compared to the continuum field theory that we had before, it's now on a lattice, and in consequence, you get a lattice propagator for the electron. So this is not just a few squared over 2m, but it has this cosine form reflecting the lattice structure. It's clear also the type of fields that we want to study. For example, we want to study the magnetization. The antiferromagnetic order is in this bilinear. And we want to study the density, which is, of course, simply in this bilinear. So we may now first introduce sources for these bilinears in our theory. These are the sources J, and compute again the effect, the generating function for the connected strange functions by evaluating them as a function of G rho and Gm, and then making the Legendre transform and computing the effective action as a function of these bilinear order parameters now. An easy way of doing that is actually partial bosonization, where you take where you use a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. It's just inserting identity in the functional integral, and this replaces your effective or fermion interaction by a mass term, and you cover couplings as we had it in the ultra-cold atom case before. But here we have now two fields, and this shows you the problem. Because you find that due to simple Fields identity, reordering of fields, you find that this for fermion interaction can be either described as a squared of this density field or as minus a third of the squared of this magnetization field. So these are just equivalent expressions. And this tells you that your partially bosonized functional integral, it's of course exactly
I'm not going through the details, it has the Kawa coupling, it's mass term, but this partially Boltzmann functional integral, it is exactly equivalent to the original fermionic integral, but you only have one condition, that a linear combination of um and u rho, so these are, let's say, the part of the four fermion interaction that is put through the antiferromagnetic, and this is the part that is going to the density, you only need a condition for a linear combination of those two. So all theories independent of u rho and u m should be equivalent if they're if the sum of these two quantities gives the original u. Why is that a problem? This is a problem because you can easily now solve this type of u fermion boson interaction in mean field theory. I mean, field theory means you just take the bosonic fields as background fields and you compute the fermion fluctuations, which are now quadratic in this order. You can do it explicitly, you find a phase diagram, and here comes already the big deception, because these two phase diagrams, so you have the antiferromagnetic phase, superconducting phase, the symmetric phase, but these two phase diagrams actually depend now on the choice of these relative couplings. They both correspond to the same microscopic four fermion coupling U, but depending on the relative, how you distribute them on the antiferromagnetic, on the density component, you get very different phase diagrams. That tells you mean field theory is just not reliable. Of course, what is missing is the bosonic fluctuations. Now, same thing is actually also appearing in the critical temperature. It's difficult to see. So if you have, for example, both of these couplings is the same, then you are critical temperatures curve like that. I can barely see it myself. And if you take another value, critical temperatures like that, and you see there are large factors in between, which may make you think, okay, however will we get something reliable when we get so grossly different answers depending on the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, on the choice of field variables we have made. But this is not real physics. Real physics should really be independent of this choice of parameters, and the good truncation method should reveal that. And we know what is missing. What is missing is the bosonic fluctuations, and the reason why we got incorrect results is that they have only taken fermion fluctuations into account, but we know that there are also boson loops. And in particular, one of the interesting things is the boson loops regenerate for fermion interactions. So we have eliminated the four fermion interaction by this Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, but then as we flow, we regenerate them. This is, of course, really something very unpleasant, and fortunately, there exists a method of reabsorbing at every value of k this four fermion interaction again into a corresponding Yukawa coupling and propagator, and you do that by a k-dependent definition of your fields. So depending on k, your field is the original field plus a contribution that contains again the fermion bilinear, and in this form you can avoid, you can, let's say, be more precisely, you can now assure that your fermion coupling remains always zero during the flow, and you get a correction to the flow of the Yukawa coupling. And now you look what comes out when you make the same exercise where you study the critical temperature as a function of one of these couplings such that the sum of the two couplings u rho and u m is always given by u. So this was the field result. This is Hartwig Bock or Schwinger-Dyson, and now you get the result of the flow equation, and now they really are independent of this original choice. So this is, for example, one of the possibilities of error tests. Still another error test. You know that depending on your particular choice of degrees of freedom,
There's a certain freedom how to choose them at the beginning. Physics should be independent, but you have to find that result at the end. And of course, this light bending here is a sense, is a direct measure of the truncation error. I think I'm
on the x-axis where the ratio between these two.
I just put here one coupling, u rho over t, and it is done so that on this side all the couplings is only in one channel, on this side all the coupling is only in the magnetic channel, and the sum was always such that the total u was the same, so it should all describe the same theory. You can do much more on that. I do not want to go too much on this. I only wanted to give you a glance that this type of method can not only go to the non-perturbative range of couplings, but it can also effectively really describe the change of degrees of freedom, both by losing irrelevant degrees of freedom by decoupling, and also by introducing collective fields that do not play a role when these collective fields do not yet play a role, because they are formally there, but they do not contribute to the flow, but then they contribute to the flow only to in the region where these collective fields flow. And in this way, you can really start with the fermionic theory and then get, for example, the critical behavior of the bosonic theory at the end. Conclusions, flow equations for the effective average action. Does it work? Why does it work? When does it work? How accurately does it work? Does it work? At least there are many examples where you can say yes. And in these cases, it works well. I'm not saying it works always. Why does it work? It works because, in my view, it works because you do not have only a formal tool, but you have a flow equation that involves the right-hand side, which is very close to your physics understanding. You just need to know, just need to make a good guess on the exact propagator. And this is, of course, one of the basic quantities on which we have some experience in many models, how the propagator looks, at least roughly. And if you're not doing wrong with this propagator, then in general it will work. If you do bad things on the propagator, if you make a truncation that does not really catch the right momentum and field dependence, then you will badly fail. And this also answers immediately the question, when does it work? I think it always works when you have a truncation that has the dominant degrees of freedom and the dominant physical effects. If you omit them, you will just fail. You can test that by solving in a given truncation and look if a quantity that you have neglected, if that blows up in the flow. This is relatively easily done because you can just use the right-hand side, your truncation that you use, and then you use, let's say you have neglected the 5 to the 8 coupling, and you can just look at the flow of the 5 to the 8 coupling in your flow and look if it becomes big or not, or something like that. So you can test it. How accurately does it work? This is only known for simple examples, where we have also direct tests, and where, of course, systematic expansions can in principle be done for checks to a certain level. For other quantities, it's often much harder to really give an error estimate, even though in principle it's possible. And I think in the future, especially the lower type of questions will have to be answered in much more detail. Maybe you can also find examples where it doesn't work at all. Even so, I must say, with all my experience, I doubt that there are examples where it doesn't work at all if you do things correctly. It will simply not work if you do not know the right propagator, for example, or if there is some physical effect that you completely omit, but in principle everything is there. Since we have started in principle from an exact equation, and the only question is, can we approximate it in any reasonable way or not? Okay, now. enough of your patience. I think I will stop.